Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Mishnah, first of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to learn a bit together. And at the very least, you'll learn how to speak English correctly. The suggestion was that we talk about the question of translating Emunah into action, bringing down from the elevated level of understanding Torah into practice. So let's try to talk about that. And I think the way to do that is let's try to examine the sugya of Emunah, which is a problem for many people today, not only for the youth that we find or feeling a disconnect. I think through all ages, throughout the full world today, people are feeling a disconnect. You find that all the time. And I think that's a better understanding of Emunah will help. And then we can see perhaps if the correct understanding represents a connection between understanding and action. I think it will flow naturally. And I hope you'll find this useful also in teaching. I'm sure you're all involved in Kiruv. Sure. And so when you work, whether it's with your own children or whether it's people that you host, or the Shabbos, or people you teach, of all ages, I hope you'll find this a useful approach to the question of Emunah in a world of darkness where we really don't see things clearly. So let's ask a few questions about Emunah. I think the most basic question, and youngsters ask you this question in the so-called Kiruv world or the Baal Tshuva world, I think this is the way the question is asked, and almost always this is the central issue. They ask you, can you know Hashem? Can you know that Hashem exists, or can you not? Can you know it? Or is it something that is always a blind belief? You know, the word Emunah translates into English as faith or belief, and that means something blind. You say a leap of faith, blind belief. So that when they talk about Emunah, the word itself means to them something that cannot be known. And so the question they ask you is, can this be known, can it not be known? And the problem is this: if Hashem's existence and all that flows from it, Matan Torah and our uniqueness and the principles of Jewish history, if that can be known, then why call it Emunah? Why call it Emunah, which means blind belief, if it can be known? Talk about knowledge. And if it cannot be known, why should I believe it? That's what bothers them. If there's no point of fixity, if I cannot know it, why should I commit my life to something and maybe have to die for something that cannot be known? And if it can be known, talk about knowledge. Don't call it blind belief. That's the problem. I think the reason the problem is set up that way, is because we live in a world, our context is a Christian context. The Arab issue is a different issue, perhaps we'll get time to talk about that. But the context that we live in is Christian. And the Christian approach, and no matter how from we are, right, we are defined in terms of the context. It's always been like that in Golos. And the Christian context understands that Emunah is something blind. The Christian world understands that your faith is something that you wake up one morning and you're born again and you take it on and you commit yourself to it. The fact that it's not logical is not an issue. It doesn't have to be a fixed point of knowledge. Example. I'll give you a few examples. You know that a very popular subject in the world around us is the debate between science and religion. So wherever you look, if you look in media, if you look in popular culture, you'll see a very, very popular subject is the debate between science and religion. If you look carefully, you'll notice that those debates are almost always between people who are exquisitely qualified scientifically and almost never have any religious knowledge at all. Right? Time magazine. I'm not sure it's not something you read, but you know, the people I deal with read it. A couple of years ago, they ran a debate between two world-famous scientists about science and religion. Francis Collins, a very, very devout Christian, he was a Nobel Prize-winning geneticist, and a fellow called Dawkins, who's a rabid atheist. a biologist, and Dawkins took the atheistic position, and Collins took the religious position and had a debate. Neither one has any religious qualification. They're superbly qualified scientifically, highly intelligent. Neither one has any religious training, and they spot nonsense religiously. And the reason is, because in the Christian world, religion is not something you have to study or have to know. It's a feeling, it's a belief. So you can argue well with no credentials, no need credentials. I have an extreme example. Some time ago, I was travelling from London to South Africa overnight. Long overnight flight. And I happened to be sitting next to a fellow who tells me that he's an Episcopalian charismatic preacher. Don't ask me what it is, but it's Christian. Right. So during this long flight, he tried, over the course of about 10 hours, to convert me to Christianity. So about 2:30 in the morning, he's explaining to me that the reason I should become a Christian is because the founder of Christianity has all the qualifications for being the Mashiach. And one of the qualifications he has is that he's descended from the house of David. Because his father, Joseph, the carpenter in Bethlehem, is descended from Beit Yehuda. Right? Because all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they all trace his genealogy from Yehuda. Yeah, slightly differently, but they all agree that Joseph, the carpenter in Bethlehem, the father of... what's his name? He is descended from... and Mashiach has to be Ben David. So after he carefully showed me that he's descended from the correct genealogy, I said to him, but if you as a Christian, surely you believe that his father was not involved in his birth? Logical problem? Right? Okay. So he said to me, what does logic have to do with religion? And he wasn't being facetious. He meant that I'm confused. He meant that religion is a... he told me that the less logical it is, the better they will be. Because it's an act of faith. Right? So our way of thinking, that's ridiculous. You know, a few years ago in Yerushalayim, they organized a classic debate between religion and science. And on that occasion, they had Rabban even knew what they were speaking about. And the main speaker was a person called Rabbi Revson. He's an Englishman with a very dry sense of humor. Not the American taste, but... And the debate went like this. The first speaker was a world-famous astrophysicist, extremely atheistic, unfortunately Jewish, whose great-grandfather wrote the Talmudic dictionary. But be that as it may, he's an atheistic individual, and he spoke first, and he began the debate like this. He said, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know much about religion. First of all, can you imagine being invited to international debate? And your first statement is that you don't know anything about the subject. But that's acceptable in the world of religion. So he said, I don't know much about religion, but I think it can be summed up as do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And on the basis of that principle, he gave his talk. Rabbi Revson was the second speaker. He got up and he said, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know much about astrophysics, but I think it can be summed up as twinkle, twinkle, little star. So the point is that if your attitude to emuna and religion is that it's a personal belief with no point of fixity, that is extremely... the Jewish mind finds that disturbing. Right? You've got to make a commitment. Your mind doesn't believe anything. And you cannot even debate the subject. You can't argue about it. Because if two people have two different religious perspectives, you might find yourself arguing with a Christian or a Haitian Buddhist. You can't argue. He's entitled to believe what he wants. And in Western morals today, in England, for example, where I live, it's considered impolite to argue about religion. What right do you have to insult somebody's religion? He's got a right to his belief, whatever he believes. If it's mutually contradictory and exclusive with yours, that's cool, that's fine. He can believe what he wants, you believe what you want. Which means you're trashing the concept completely. That's the problem, that's the context. So the question the beginner asks you again, can you know that Hashem exists, or can you not know it? If you know it, let's talk about knowledge. Why don't you give me the knowledge? And if you cannot know it, it's not for me. Why should I commit myself to something that has no proof? So what's an authentic approach to this? I think the right approach to this subject is... I think a more mature approach to the subject is this. How claim is that you can know Hashem? When a youngster asks you this question, the answer should be that it's knowledge. We have knowledge. And the goal, the process of our development and emunah, is to come to that knowledge, like the Rambam uses the Lashon of Das, Leida Shiyesham Motzi Rishon. We talk about Das. Das not only means knowledge, Das means an intimate knowledge. Das means a bonding of the knowledge with the self. That's our claim. But if that's true, it leaves us with two questions. The first question is, how do you get the knowledge? Obviously. And the second question is, why call it emuna? Which means belief. So how do you get the knowledge? I don't think we can cover this morning. There are many wonderful sources on that, both ancient and modern. You have a Kuzari, and you have, which deals with the classic and essential elements of the question. You have modern Perushim on that. There are many, many ways to access that, both in English and in many different forms. But just to perhaps set the direction, if I had to speak to a beginner or in the Kiruv setting, some of the features that experience has shown make a strong impact, I will just mention briefly. And that is this: I would say that if a person asks you, on what is our knowledge founded? How do we know that Hashem exists? I think the important points to make are as follows, and I would urge you to take these seriously, because experience has shown that if you begin this way, you can make a lot of progress. The first point to make is to tell the person that there's no such thing as absolute knowledge. That's very important. In any basic philosophy course, the first thing they teach you is that the human mind is not capable of absolute knowledge, and it's correct. Some of Forshim say, by the way, that if you had absolute knowledge, you'd have no Bechira. And therefore, it's very important to tell your students that we are not talking about absolute knowledge, because we can never meet that standard. And it's very easy to demonstrate that we can never have absolute knowledge of anything. Right? For example, you can't even know that you're awake. You know that? Let me ask you a question. Are you awake right now? And those of you who are. Are you awake right now? What would you say? You awake? Okay. Are you sure? Okay. Are you absolutely sure? No. You might be back at home in bed, sleeping, dreaming that you're listening to an amazing talk on the question of Emuna, right? And you think you're awake. When you dream, you think you're awake. Right? That's why in a dream you can go through ecstasy or abject terror, because you think you're awake. So how come when you're awake you know you're awake? I mean, this shouldn't bother you. If it bothers you seriously, you know, you need therapy. The point is that you cannot know for sure that you're awake. And by the way, the most important things in life cannot be known absolutely for sure. That you're Jewish, that you're human as opposed to animal, that there's an absolute right and wrong. There are many things. The most important things in consciousness cannot be known absolutely. And therefore, it's a mistake to set up a goal and a target of absolute knowledge, because you won't reach that standard and you'll leave your student disappointed. I think people who run Kiruv seminars and they tell people that they're walking on Friday afternoon as a skeptical atheist, and they walk out Sunday evening as a fanatic, you know, ultra-Orthodox type. I think it's a mistake, because you don't meet that standard, you leave people disappointed. I think what we should be advertising is not proof, but evidence. We can amass compelling evidence, but we don't have proof. The Ramban says in the introduction to the Milchomas, he says that in Torah there's no absolute proof. In Torah there's no absolute proof. Not only that, he says in the rise that he's going to bring in Torah, it doesn't even amount to the standard that you can achieve in mathematics and engineering. That's what he says about his own parish. And it's important to know that, because when you speak to a student and you challenge, the challenge is, I will give you compelling evidence, you can meet that standard. But if you tell him you're going to give him proof and you fall short of the proof, you've left him worse than he was before. And therefore, we shouldn't be talking about proof. We should be talking about compelling evidence. And if the person says, but that's not good enough, then you show him that he has nothing better in the rest of his life. Because anything that we do in the rest of our lives is always predicated on evidence, never on proof. Even life and death things, when you fly in a plane, or you trust a surgeon, or you do something really dangerous, like get married, you know, whatever it is, you can never base it on absolute proof. All you can ever do is amass good enough evidence. And therefore, the point to make is that if you will predicate an action, if you'll trust your life to a situation that has 85 or 95%, whatever the 98, 99% evidence, then in religion you ought to accept the same standard. When I force someone in a discussion or a debate to admit that in the rest of his life he accepts 90% or 95% evidence, and he wants from me 100%, I cannot meet that standard, I won't engage the discussion. But when he admits that he's ready to accept 95% evidence elsewhere, and I claim I'll give him the same level of evidence here, and he's honest, then he'll accept that. And therefore, I think the first point to make in your discussion with a beginner is that we're not looking for a standard of absolute proof, we're looking for compelling evidence. And particularly in the era that's post-prophetic, right? We live in the generations in which there's no Nebuah. Even in the time of Nebuah, there was no proof. But it was a much higher standard, it was direct experience. The Rambam says when a Novi spoke, you experienced what he was saying. right? And now you hear people talk about something. But even back then, the truth is the Ramban points out that even Matan Torah, the day after, Rav Tzadok HaKohen says that if Aristotle would have been present with Matan Torah, the next day he would have brought Moshe Rabbeinu 100 proofs that it couldn't have happened the day before. And therefore, I think it's a very important starting point. So point one is you set the standard. The standard is compelling evidence. And then the person says to you, what's the evidence? And the formal answer to that is two pillars. One is Matan Torah, we met Hashem personally. That's the foundation. But Moshe Shapiro says the first sugya to learn with beginners is Matan Torah. And the second is scientific philosophical investigation of the world around us. And each of these needs its own full discussion. The Matan Torah experience, the thing to point out there, many wonderful things to point out, but one thing that makes a great impression on people who come into it for the first time is to point out to them that it's the only time in the history of mankind that anyone has ever claimed divine revelation with even one witness present. It's very important. This is not a proof, of course, but it sets the tone. That means if you look at the history of religion, any sect, any cult, any religion, you'll find that they're all founded on one person's testimony. Not even one eight. Mefarshim Rishonim make this point. It says, has Hashem ever taken one nation out of another, like I took you out of Mitzrayim, or Hanishma Kamohu? Has anyone even purported that such an event took place? And if you look at Christianity, for example, Christianity begins with Paul's famous vision on the Damascus Road. And when the Jews said to him, who saw this vision with you? He said it was private. They said, not good enough for us. Muhammad came out of his tent. Allah spoke to him the Quran. Who was with you? Private, not good enough. Wherever you go, you can go to Utah. Fellow woke up in 1880 and said, God spoke to him, and who was with you? Private. And hundreds of thousands of people followed it. In our book, that's ridiculous. But what's remarkable is that, and for sure someone's lying. You know, all three Western religions, right? You have Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. All three agree that Matan Torah is correct. They all agree that we're right. And they call them infidels, and they call them dogs. So somebody's lying, and for sure it's not us. Okay? And despite lying, you have no evidence, not even one witness, not even the chutzpah to pay a witness. Remarkable thing. But what bothers beginners more than that, much more than that, is how can you trust the story? How can you trust the story? You know, you're talking about innumerable generations. A story transmitted through stage after stage, through the mists of time. How can you trust a story like that? No way it could be accurate. If I whisper something in his ear, and he whispers it in his ear, by the time it gets down to that, it will have nothing to do with the original story. You can show that easily. So the beginner says to you, you know, it created over time. It began as, it probably began as a few Abrahamic nomads in the desert, probably smoking something very good, you know, and having visions. And that, you know, escalated and became Torah. That's what a lot of people believe out there. And on the face of it, that's a challenge. You know, you're talking about a story transmitted through thousands of generations. How do you handle that? This is a very important point to know, because you can demonstrate beautifully the incompetence of that claim. And the way to do it is this. You know that if you call a generation 40 years, not enough time for parents to tell their children, even tell their grandchildren, and you say Matan Torah happened, let's take a round number, 3,200 years ago. How many times does 40 divide into 3,200? I see math, not your strong point. 80 times, that's all. 80. 80 generations, and the Rambam lists them. In Hasdonah to the Mishnayos, the Rambam lists the name of the leader of every generation from Matan Torah to our generation. We know who they were, and in most cases we have the original writing. In the case of the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, you have a fragment of every single part of Tanakh except for Megillas Esther, and they're identical with what we have today. You're talking about at least 2,100 years old, and exactly the same. My friend Rabbi Becha told me he took his kids to see them. His 10-year-old climbed up in a box, and he started reading a scroll of Yeshaya that's 2,100 years old. He said, oh, we learned this 10 days ago in school. Rabbi Becha said, the real miracle is the kid remembers what he learned 10 days ago in school. you got a Jewish child reading a scroll of Yeshaya, that's exactly the same, right, as we have today. And it's a remarkable thing. For most of those 3,200 years, we've been dispersed. You're talking about Jews sitting down at a Pesach Seder and telling their children in Yemen and in Tunis and in Africa and in Poland, telling their children exactly the same story in exactly the same words. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable corroboration. You know, I had an amazing experience a few months ago. I was able to go and see the Cairo Geniza. You know that in Fosfat, in Cairo, where the Rambam lived in 1896, they discovered a room in the shul, when they were redecorating, in which there were more than 200,000 documents that the community had been keeping for 1,800 years. 185,000 of those documents are in Cambridge today, in London, in England. And you can go there. I held in my hands a fragment of a Sefer Torah written in the year 600. You're talking about long before Islam became a religion. They have business letters of the Arizal. They have the signature of Rabbi Yosef Karo. They have a hechsher on cheese given by the Rabbonim of Cairo to a Karaite Jew. They made him take a shul on the Sefer Torah because the Karaite didn't accept anything else, right? You have ksubas there. You see, they have 400 ksubas. I hold in my hands a ksuba written between a Jew in Cairo and a Karaite woman, signed by 11 Rabbonim in Cairo. Of course, this stopped immediately when the Rambam arrived. And in that ksuba it says, I give you permission to sit in darkness on Shabbos, he says to his wife, provided you allow me to have light on Shabbos. Amazing stuff. I held in my hands a siddur of a child from the year 1100. The only document in color, by the way. In this siddur, you have a first page. The child has practiced aleph, 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 base, base, base. And then he's drawn a little picture of himself on his camel. Right? They have the Rambam's lawn. They have the Rambam's kisvayad. Beautiful. You see, for example, he writes there, Hilchas Mamon. And it's erased, and underneath it says Hilchas Niske Mamon, like we have. Unbelievable. You have after 3 or 4 hours there, I was able to identify his handwriting myself and his brother David. And the last letter that his brother wrote to him before he was lost at sea, the letter says, we were lost in the desert, we traveled for 3 weeks, Baruch Hashem, we survived. We're about to get on the ship and I'm coming to see you. And that was the last letter before the ship went down. And the end of the letter is smudged, and they think it's the Rambam's tears. So you can hold, you're talking about a corroboration that's unbelievable. By the way, the Haggadahs have 5 questions. The Haggadahs have, why don't we eat roasted meat on this night? Right? But you're talking about identical things going back to the year 600. So when somebody says to you, you're talking about, you know, vague story 2000, you're talking about an unbelievably corroborated, you're talking about Jews throughout 3,200 years agreeing on the, first of all, can you imagine all Jews agreeing? You know, I mean, that is an amazing, Martin Torres, nothing compared to that. So, point one is that people need to know that there's incredible corroboration of the story. It's a very important place to begin. And then the second discussion is scientific investigation, philosophical inquiry, and that also has its unique features. For the Olam, I'll mention just one of those. I was very close to Rav Simcha Wasserman, that's all. He was a master of teaching beginners. He used to put it like this. He said, when you go into philosophical inquiry and discussion about science and about proving that Hashem exists in the world, it's important to point out that those are always proofs by exclusion. They're always proofs by exclusion. That means in science and math and logic, there are only 2 ways to prove something. You either prove it by derivation or by exclusion. Derivation means you take the first principle that we can experience, you build complexity on that, and finally you arrive at the thing you want to prove. That's called derivation. Exclusion means A or B must be true. I cannot prove A, but I can disprove B. That's a rigorous proof of A. All proofs of Hashem's existence are always proofs by exclusion. You can never derive. You can never get to Hashem by derivation. You have to be Him to do that. All you can say is the world's either a random accident or it's not. To the extent that you suggest that the world does not look like a random accident, by exclusion, that proves something else. But the difference is this, a major difference. When you prove a thing by derivation, you end up proving it and understanding what it is because you proved it. You worked it out from the basic principles. When you prove a thing by exclusion, you end up knowing it must be true, but only because the alternative is not right. But what this thing is, you have no idea. And therefore, you come to proofs of Hashem's existence by exclusion, it means you can deduce that it must be true, but what it is, you haven't explored at all. For that, you need Torah. And therefore, that's an important point to make about that. So, in summary of part one, what have we said? We have said that our claim is that you can know Hashem, it's a chiyuv, and that's what you tell a beginner. How do you know Hashem? These are the fundamentals. There's much more, of course, just since they used to say that when you start learning Gemara, the questions fall away. When you start learning Gemara with the beginner, the questions, other questions arise. Say that. But the fundamental questions that he thinks are the real issues, once he gets into it, and by the way, I would say in Kirub, just as an aside, when you start learning Gemara with somebody, that's when the kinyan is made on him. Until then, he's a spectator. You know the Kirub process? The first step in Kirub is your wife's chalas, the homemade chalas, it's a Shabbos atmosphere. All Balei Tshuva will tell you. That's what began the process, not intellectualism. Because when a person's not ready to hear intellectually, nothing goes in. And when they're ready, it goes in easily. So it's the first thing you take an interest in, you show an interest, it's the experience, it's the values, and after that it's hashkaf. Hashkaf, the machshava, the person's blown away by ideas, it's wonderful. But a kinyan is made only when he starts learning Gemara, because then he's got to engage in himself. And by the way, all of you in this room, you, if you think, what can I do in Kirub? I can't teach people, what machshava can I say? All you need is learn Gemara with something, that you can do. Sit down with a beginner, just show him what a page of Gemara is, what's Rashi, what's Tosfos, give a bit of the history, the structure. Simple ideas, learn the Mishnah. People are blown away by it. They have no idea what it is. And they have no defenses because you're teaching them something completely unfamiliar. They don't need to defend against it. And therefore, that's all you have to do. Don't worry about the shkofa and the fancy footwork and the philosophical stuff. Sit down with a beginner, make him work it out himself. And to give a good Gemara shir, you must explain nothing. You give a shir and you explain it clearly, it's good for you. He'll fall asleep. The way you give a good Gemara shir, you make him work it out. If he doesn't work out with a headache, you failed. He's got to engage. They told me that's the sweat blood. He's got to engage it. He's got to feel the challenge and the thrill of solving the problems. That's the most important step. Once he starts playing the game himself, that's what it is. Anyway, that's the discussion. That's the part one. But what I'd like to turn our attention to, in a bit more detail, is part two. Why call it Emunah? If our claim is, I'll give you evidence, I'll give you compelling evidence, then why do we have a thing called Emunah, which means blind belief? And here's the key. Emunah does not mean blind belief. Emunah does not mean belief. Emunah is mistranslated in the Christian world as blind belief, because that's their version of it. That's not what it means to us. The correct translation of Emunah is not faith, but faithfulness. It means the emunah. Emunah does not mean blind belief. We're not into that, to leap off cliffs in blind belief because you think it's a good idea. It's ridiculous. Emunah means that once you get the knowledge, you're going to be Ne'eman to the knowledge. Right, first of all, look in text. Look in text. Go through Tanakh, and look at the word Emunah. Moshe Rabbeinu is holding his hands up in the battle against Amalek. And it says, Bahayu Yadav Emunah at Bahashamish. His hands were faith. Ridiculous. His hands were faithful. They stayed put. Avraham Avinu is talking to Hashem. And it says, Behemin Bashem. So you read a King James Bible, it says, and he believed in God. He didn't believe in God. And now he doesn't believe in God. He's speaking to him. It means he was Ne'eman to this God who asked him to kill his own child. The Medrash says, before Hashem created the world, He'emin ba'olamoy ubro'oy. Hashem believed in his world. He believed in his world. It means he carried thought into action. The plan, the project was Ne'eman to the concept. Emunah does not mean blind belief, that's worthless. Emunah means a Ne'emanus. It means a logical, loyal, tenacious attachment to the concept. It means translation of concepts into action. That's what Ne'eman is. You know, the concept is this. When you say Yav Emunah, right? You say, you've got to get the knowledge. Yiddishkeit begins with critical, rigorous analysis. That's what Gemara is. But once you have the knowledge, why would you not live it? What idiot would know a thing clearly, this is the direction, and then walk in the opposite direction? The answer is, with all due respect, you. Because we are constructed in such a way that we can see a thing clearly and completely betray it. And that happens all the time. You only have to think about somebody trying to diet. Diet. Imagine it's very important for you to diet, your health depends on it. You see it clearly, you know that if you diet a certain way, exercise, you'll get to exactly, you know, look the way you look, self-respect, next summer on the Frum beach, you know. You see it clearly. And on the other hand, you have this little wedge of chocolate thing with a bit of cream and a cherry. You know, you're talking about your health, your future, your self-esteem, maybe your life, as opposed to 10 seconds of pleasure during which you'll feel like a jerk. And a minute later, you're looking at a plate that is licked clean. It's like, whatever. You know, how does that work? Good. How do people do that? You know, the experience I always relate to with when I was a junior intern in surgery, I had a patient who had Berger's disease. In the hospital, we had this man. He was a 45-year-old, highly intelligent engineer. And he had this disease. Berger's disease is a genetic susceptibility to the nicotine in cigarette smoke. People who have this disease, the nicotine makes their blood vessels close down. First their fingers fall off, then their hands fall off. They have multiple amputations. If they stop smoking, the disease stops. They carry on smoking, their body falls apart. This man had a blocked artery to his leg. The main artery supplying his leg is closing down due to smoking. He had four black toes we had to cut off that day. And this man knew that if he carried on smoking, we'd have to do an amputation of his leg. Yeah. He carried on smoking, and 3 weeks later, we were forced to do an above-knee amputation. The next time I saw him, I was a senior intern in surgery, and I saw them wheeling him down the hospital corridor in a wheelchair with no legs, smoking, on his way to losing an arm. Now, I had a friend in New York who has a colleague who's a vascular surgeon. He told me that he had a patient like this. When he lost his second arm, he had his friends rig up some wire on the wheelchair so he could carry on smoking. Now, let's just get that clear. Man stands there with a cigarette and a leg. Let's just get where the clarity is. Cigarette, leg. Cigarette, leg. Throw away the cigarette. Live, leg. Walk. Man, husband, father, leg. Or 30 seconds of pleasure during which you'll feel the cold hand of death. How could you get that wrong? The answer is that the human being is constructed in such a way that you can see clarity in one direction, you can walk in the opposite direction. You can take it from here and fail to bring it down to here. The distance from here to here is a long way. Or from here to here, wherever it is. And that is the problem. The Zohar puts it like this. Listen to this amazing statement. The Zohar says that Emunah, actually the Zohar says Emes. Emes has two components. Emes and Emunah. And the Zohar says, E hu emes, the E yi emuna. There's a male thing called emes, and there's a female thing called emuna. And to be an integrated human being, you need both. You need an emes, which is clear. But unless you can bring it down into action, into feelings and into action, what are you worth? And that's first of all, there's clarification. Not like a non-Jewish world where it's a leap of faith and it doesn't need logic. No. It's got to be rigorously, critically analyzed. And once that's firm and clear, there's a second work. Can you make it happen? Can you walk the walk? There's no guarantee that one does not guarantee the other. Note the Maharal in the Siva Emunah. The Maharal brings the Aruch. The Aruch talks about the story of the Bor and Chulda. Right? Look it up in the Aruch, it's under Chulda, Chelet. The Aruch talks about the Bor and the Chulda, and the Maharal brings a fantastic analysis of this. Time now to go into the details, but briefly, the Maharal says this. He says that the story of the Bor and the Chulda, before she said, by the way, Bor and Chulda is also female and male. But the story is this. There's a young woman who was on her way to visit her father. She was wearing her Shabbos clothes and all the jewelry. And on her way to visit her father, she strayed into a wilderness. And in that desert, she was completely lost. And accidentally, she fell into a Bor. And the Bor was very deep. She couldn't climb out. There was no one around. She certainly would have died there. She began crying. And it so happened there was a young man walking past. He heard her cries. He walked over to the boy. He looked down. He saw a woman. He said, "Who are you?" She said her name. She was a Jewish girl. He was a Jewish young man. He was a Kohen, in fact. He said to her, "Are you human?" He thought she was one of the Shadim in the desert. She said, "I'm human." He said, "Make a shvur." How would that help, by the way? Would the liar make a shvur that he's telling the truth? They cannot use Shemus of Hashem, the Shemus. The Kirkus of Tumah. So she made a shvur of the Shemus Hashem. "I believe you. If I save you, will you marry me?" So she said yes. Didn't have much choice, did she? He lifted out of the Bor, and he wanted to consummate the marriage on the spot. She said, "That's not decent. That's not how we behave. I will go back to my town and get ready for the chasana. You go back to your town. You give me time to prepare. Then after you've given me enough time to prepare, you come meet my parents. And then we'll get married." So he agreed. Then they wanted to make a vot. But for a vot, you need Edim. They were not Edim, it was a wilderness. So they decided to take the only two things that were present to be their Edim. The Bor and a Chulda that was running past. There's nothing else. So they promised each other they would be married, had a commitment. She went back to her town and prepared for the wedding. He went back to his town and forgot. In fact, it's even more embarrassing than that. It says, Kevan she'avol mipaneha. As soon as he was out of sight, he forgot. Eventually, he met another woman. He got married. She became pregnant. She had a child. The child fell into a boar and died. She had another child. The child was bitten by a chuba. She turned to her husband. She said, this is bizarre. And then he remembered the story of the boar and the chuba. And he told her. And she said, if that's true, you divorce me. If you go back to the town that you remember that girl said she came from all those years before. He says, a woman is waiting and a woman is teaching you. So the Aruch says he divorced her. And he went back to the town that he remembered the woman came from. And he went into the town and he found her father. And the father said, unfortunately, you can no longer see her. She's lost her mind. The waiting has made her insane. People go near her. She shreds her clothing. She's just insane. But he begged to be allowed to see her. And he went into the room where the girl was. And she started tearing his clothes and behaving. And he said to her, Boran Chulda. She recognized him. And she then revealed to him that she'd been pretending to be insane so that no one else could marry her. Laura said they got married, they had children, a happy life together. What does this mean? It means there's Zohar and the Kepha, there's MS and Emunah. MS is the male faculty, it's clarification. Who are you? Make a shmur. Yes. And instant results. Instant gratification. Results now. Total clarification. Staying power, zero. Female. Logic clarification, zero. Hopeless. Lost in the desert. No idea where she is. Staying power, unbelievable. You made a commitment. You said you'd wait. And you wait. Not logical. What are the chances he'll come back? That's irrelevant. This is logic. This is the one. And that's the story. The story is you have Zohar and the Kevin. You know, when the child is conceived, you have exactly that. When the child is conceived, there's male and female. The male component is instant clarification, and it's only instant. The conception of a child is giving of a half a genetic code, that's all there is. There's no staying power, there's no tenacious attachment, there's no pain, there's no suffering, that's all there is. And the whole pregnancy is female. Day after day after day of discomfort, and greater discomfort, and crisis, and pain, and risk. There's both. It takes both to produce a life result in the world. There's the Zohar component, which is clarification and instant, and there's the Nekeva component, which is Emunah, Ne'emonas. That's the, you know that we talk about Chemle Mashiach. Chemle Mashiach, the birth process in the world. We'll have to be a woman. We'll have to manifest the Emunah component. Jewish people have to be that great woman, right to the Zohar. That's the comment. You know, there's a Medrash that says, you should look at that. Medrash called Beis HaMedrash. Long, long, beautiful Medrash Tanoim. The Medrash says that before Mashiach comes, the Arabs will have a building on the Har HaBayis. This was written centuries before Islam became a religion. You're talking about the Medrash Tanoim. The Medrash says that the Bnei Yishmael will have a building where the Beis HaMikdash should stand. And just before Mashiach arrives, the leaders of the Jews, don't ask me who they are, but the leaders of the Jews will go to the Bnei Yishmael and they will say to them, remove your building, we want to build a third Bayis. And the Bnei Yishmael will say, no, it's our place. And there will be a moment of tension. And then the Bnei Yishmael will turn to the Jews and they'll say to them, why should we make a battle? Let's build a Mizbech and put a korban on. And you Jews, you build a Mizbech, you put a korban on. And let's see if fire comes in the Shemayim for which of our offerings. We trust, we have Emunah. We have real Emunah, Arabs, in case you haven't noticed. More than life itself. But we make a deal with you. If Hashem accepts our offering, you join our religion. And if he accepts yours, we'll follow the Torah. And the Jews agree. The Medrash says the Jews build a Mizbech, they put a korban on. The Arabs build a Mizbech, they put a korban on. It doesn't say where, it sounds like on the Har HaBayis. The Medrash doesn't say where. And fire comes min haShemayim for the Arabs' korban. Emunah is a test, right? Emunah means, can you hold on even when it's not logical? At that moment, the Arabs turn to the Jews and they say, we had a deal. The Jews say, never. Shema Yisrael HaShem Elokeinu HaShem Echad. There's a terrible battle. Those who survive flee to the desert. And after 40 days of hiding in the desert, the Mashiach arrives. And the Medrash says, he goes to Hebron, he wakes up the Avos, he brings him out of the Machpelah. Very, very beautiful, a long, long Medrash. I once asked Rav Simcha, would it be like that? And he said, it will be exactly like that. Birth is a process where it doesn't look like, you know, just if you permit me for a moment, speaking medically. You know, when a child is born, you know what happens? First of all, it looks like the mother's dying. Looks like a mother's love. No question. If you didn't know how children were born, if you had no idea, and you stumbled into a room accidentally when that was happening, you know, you'd call the police. You'd need therapy. And if you had to go through it yourself, you would never recover. But the child certainly looks like it's dying. You know what happens to the baby in the womb as it's about to be born? You know that the child in the mother's womb has 25 conditions that keep it alive there, any of which would kill it when it's born? And your body has 25 different conditions that keep you alive that would kill you if you were given it to a fetus? The baby in the mother's womb has holes in his heart, blood flowing in the opposite direction, he has no blood going to his lungs, his lungs are little closed bits of tissue. One of the biggest blood vessels in the body takes all the blood away from the lungs in the opposite direction. He's got blood vessels coming out of his umbilicus. He's got the wrong sort of blood, hemoglobin. He's got 20 different reasons that keep him alive in the womb. Any of those would kill him instantly when he's born. Mama's life and death opposite. And all the things that he needs when he's outside, if he had inside, he'd be dead. And this child with all these conditions begins to be born. You know, the Nefesh HaChai, the Gesher HaChai in Chelek Gimel, he talks about two twins in the womb. And it talks about one twin being born. And as the twin starts to be born, the other child in the womb begins to mourn. Begins to mourn for him. There's no way he can survive. There's dozens of reasons why he'll die. Here, of course, he's talking about Leilena standing at a graveside when somebody's being buried. And we stand there crying. Little do we know that that's where life begins. That's his famous marshal. But it's based on fact. And speaking as a doctor, I've delivered dozens of babies. You stand there, hold this little baby in your head. Child comes out. He goes blue. A minute later, he goes purple. He starts to make these terrible gasping movements. There's no way he can breathe. His lungs have never opened before. He's bleeding furiously. A newborn child has about a cup full of blood, that's all. And he's bleeding like crazy. There's 10 different reasons why he's about to die. And as you stand there, hold this little baby in your hands, first the umbilical cord clamps down like a cord of steel and stops the bleeding. At exactly the same moment, the holes in the heart close. At exactly that moment, the blood reverses direction. At exactly the same moment, the blood vessel taking blood away from the lungs closes and the blood hits the lungs. At exactly the same moment, he takes his first breath and the air hits the lungs. And about 3.5 minutes later, it's all reversed and he's doing fine. That must have taken a good few million years in the trees to get right by accident, you know. There must have been a lot of chimpanzees, you know, that didn't make it, you know. Yeah, ask the evolutionists how that happened. But the point is that you have one phase reverse itself. And that's the moment of birth. That's the moment of crisis. This is, by the way, why we sing Eshet Chayil on Leil Shabbos. Because a woman has been through that in her flesh. And so when the week becomes Shabbos, which is a premonition of this world becoming Yemos HaMashiach, at that moment of transition, it's a woman. But Tishchak Beyom, that's funny. But Tishchak Beyom Achron, that's really funny. To go through an experience that feels like she's dying, when there's no question the child is going to die, for dozens of reasons, and that brings life to the world. That's what Tishchak Beyom Achron. That's really funny. That's a woman. And that's the point. The point is that you have MS, but it's not enough. You can learn all the Torah in the world. You can be a genius in Torah. You can know facts. But unless you can bring it down into the world of reality, unless you can bring it down into the emotions and the organs of action, unless you can not just think the think, but talk the talk and walk the walk, what are you worth? That's the concept. What's one without the other? You know, you have intellect, and you understand it well, and you cannot make it real in the world. If you like, there's a famous, without mentioning names, one of the great British philosophers of the last century. He taught his students the most incredible moral philosophy. One morning the students found him crawling out of a house of very ill repute. Disgusting. They said, "Professor, how could you teach us such great moral philosophy and behave in such a disgusting fashion?" He said, "What's the problem? Does a mathematician have to be a triangle?" The head without the actions, pure hypocrisy. And what is the actions without the head? What happens when you have emunah without emes? When you have unbelievable emunah and nothing up here? You see it around you. Very dangerous. Unbelievable emunah. Life itself is nothing. Kill, be killed. A tremendous attachment to what he wants. It's the Arab world. It's the Arab world. Right? Unbelievable emunah. But it's scrambled eggs up here. Very dangerous. I'm not sure which is worse. Which is worse? You have the logic, you cannot make it happen in the world. Hypocrisy. You have tremendous emunah, there's nothing up here. No logic, just need both. To be integrated human being, you need male and female. There's the Zachon Nekeva that makes the Das. And the Das is comprised of two things. There's the clarification, there's the Emes, there's understanding things, there's the understanding Torah. All the sugyas. The definition of the Talmud Chacham is Havonos HaSugyas in Shas. All the sugyas. Machshava sugyas. Agadah. Based on Allah, everything. But unless you can make it happen in the world, worth nothing. Let me finish with a story, if I may. Here's a story about 3-4 weeks ago. An old Japanese man died. He was 91 years old. His name was Hiro Onoda. I'd like to tell you a story. Onoda, this is what happened. In 1942, the Japanese invaded the Philippines during the war. 1944, just before the end of the war, they left. But a strange series of incidents continued happening in the Filipino jungle. People were being shot to death. 30 people died. Why? Because one Japanese soldier, Lieutenant Onoda, got left behind by accident. And he carried on fighting the war. It's on his own. And he carried on hiding in the jungle, fighting the war against the Filipinos. His orders were to fight to the death. You know, Japanese, there was no surrender. And he continued fighting the war. This went on for a long time. It went on for 30 years. I've seen a photograph. 54 years old. In his uniform. Patches. His gun. 30 years. In 1974, the Japanese government, you know, they were getting complaints. They sent a certain fellow called Suzuki into the Philippines and found him in his uniform with his gun. He said, "What are you doing?" He said, I'm being loyal to my task. My commanding officer ordered me to fight, and that's what I'm doing." He said, "You know you are being totally logical." Onoda said, "What does this have to do with logic? You're talking this, I'm doing this." He said, "A soldier's duty is not to be logical. If every soldier thinks logically, what sort of army do you have? A soldier's duty is to do his duty. And that's what I'm doing." He said, "You know the war's over?" He said, "Of course I'm not a fool. The war's over. What are you doing? Where's the logic?" He said, "There's not logic. I'm doing my duty. I was given orders and I'm doing it." He was unable to convince him to go home. Suzuki went back. Onoda carried on fighting the war. Eventually the Japanese high command found a solution. They found the man who had been his commanding officer during the war, an older fellow. They sent him back into the jungle and he found him, called him to attention. And he pulled out the original Japanese evacuation order to lay down weapons and go home, and he read it to him. Another handed over his gun, went back to Japan. Then the Filipinos called him a hero. They bought him a new blue suit. It was very emotional. He came to Tokyo Airport. He hadn't seen his parents for 30 years. His parents came to meet him. His family came. Thousands of people came to meet him. He came back to an industrial modern Japan. That's a very interesting story. But imagine you standing there in the jungle and you say to him, "Onoda, let's go." And he says, "No." And you say, "Why?" And he says, "Because I'm doing my duty." And you say, "But you're being illogical." And he says, "This man is doing logic." What would you say? What would you say to him? Talk about emunah. Talk about ne'emonos. So I asked this question to a group of school children in London. And one girl said, "He had emes. He had emunah, but he did not have emes." That's right. Need both. You need to have the MS. It's got to be right. If you're going to make a 30-year commitment and it's going to involve life and death, it needs to be right. And therefore, that is the concept of Torah and Yiddishkeit. And that's our history. Our history is we have the generations of Nevuah where it couldn't be clearer, where it approaches absolute knowledge as close as it gets, where we experience it, where there's Torah Shvik Sav coming down, the Vim are speaking. You see it missing when you go to the base of Mikdash. There was no atheism then. There was a lot of Torah, that's another issue, dealing with intermediaries. And then gradually the light faded. Purim, a couple hundred years later, Hanukkah, and since then we've seen nothing. Purim is the gradual fading of the light towards the end of Nebuah. Mordechai was part of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. Purim means the luck of the draw. The Megillah has no name, Shem Hashem. The nace there is a nace, but it's a hidden nace. And after that, 150 years later, you have Hanukkah. Hanukkah is nothing at all. No Megillah, not even a Mishnah. Nothing. The nace of Hanukkah was nothing like the nisim that happened before. There was no Novi present. The Rambam says you need a Novi for every nace. It was after the war was won. Only the Kohanim saw it. It was the last wave goodbye from the world of Gilui. And since then, we've seen nothing. We are deep in the pregnancy. Deep, very close to the end. where this pregnancy needs to end, with no direct evidence, no knowledge, no proof. All we have is the compelling evidence that's based on the story. That's all there is. And therefore, the work of Emuna today is the clarification of that story. It doesn't get better than that. Right? If you see a voice that's speaking to you, you know, you need to see a professional. We don't see directly. We're not in the generation of Torah Shavik Sof. That's gone. Now we have it to study. Now the work is carrying that pregnancy through loyally to the end, through the generation of the dogmas, and to reach the final stage where the crisis will be. And the only thing that will carry us through the crisis is the strength of character that knows the abyss and makes it actually happen. And that you could call Batitzchak L'Yom Achron. When that happens, we'll be able to say Az Yimol Eisrei Kedim.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.